This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Chuck Anzalevich. A week ago today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that President Donald Trump's travel ban could take effect, temporarily limiting travel of some people from six countries in the Middle East to the United States. While the Trump administration argues that the travel ban is in the interest of national security, opponents argue its purpose is to discriminate against Muslim nations. Dave Mistich from our project 100 Days in Appalachia spoke with West Virginia University law professor John Taylor about the ban, the recent Supreme Court decision, and what comes next. We begin with Taylor explaining what the latest travel ban does and how it differs from the Trump administration's earlier attempt that was blocked by several federal judges.
There are a lot of similarities in terms of what the order ultimately did. One part of the order, Section 2C of the second one, bans the entry of people from six countries for 90 days. The initial one was seven. The difference was Iraq, because we have a lot of people who've helped us in Iraq, and it was a problem to have excluded those people. It bans the admission of refugees for 120 days. And it caps the total national intake of refugees to 50,000 a year. Those, other than the seven countries to six, those things don't change a lot between the two. But the implementation was much more careful. For example, in the second one, it included lengthy recitals about the unstable conditions in the six countries, explaining why these were thought to be a particular security threat. Also, there has been some language in the first order suggesting that basically Christian refugees would be given priority over other refugees, and given the backdrop of concern of sort of religious discrimination lurking in the background of this whole enterprise, that certainly hurt them legally as well, and that language was removed in the second executive order.
And so, you know, the argument for both these orders from one side has been that it's religious discrimination, it's xenophobic, it's Islamophobic, so to speak. What is the argument from the Trump administration as to why we need this?
Well, the claim all along has been national security, and the notion that the vetting being done by us and the information being provided by other countries was not adequate to screen out terrorists. And then the further argument that the relevant agencies are so overburdened screening people now that if they don't take a break, they won't have time to do the kind of review that is purportedly necessary to make sure that the procedures are up to snuff. So that's been their argument all along. The contention from the other side has been that if you're trying to sort of use countries of origin as a proxy for how likely it is for somebody to commit a terrorist act, it's a pretty bad proxy. And the case has been hurt further by the fact that documents leaked out of Homeland Security between the first and second travel ban orders suggested that Homeland Security itself, in its internal review, concluded that this was not a particularly good way to protect the country from terrorism.
Right, and which leads me to the question: how exactly, leading up to this, you know, Supreme Court, you know, decision recently, what is the process by which the judges at the circuit court level have taken a look at this case? What do they evaluate whenever they say, yes, this holds, you know, this passes muster, or no, that it doesn't? You know, what is their mechanism by which they're judging these orders?
Plaintiffs went into court and challenged the second executive order almost immediately, and just as the first time, they were successful in getting nationwide injunctions against the enforcement of the order pretty quickly. And two different kinds of things are argued. One kind of argument, and this is the ground that the Ninth Circuit ultimately held the nationwide injunction out of Hawaii on, is the idea that the president exceeded his authority under the statute in concocting this ban. Another argument, and this is the one that was accepted by the Fourth Circuit, is that the travel ban violates the Establishment Clause. And there the basic notion is this can only be seen as a kind of expression of anti-Muslim sentiment, which comes from a combination of evidence concerning the president's statements, both on the campaign trail and in office, and statements of his surrogates, such as Rudy Giuliani. And also, you combine that evidence with the very flimsy and relatively easily undermined assertions that this serves national security. You put the two together and you conclude that really this is, quote, a Muslim ban and not a national security measure. And that's basically the ground on which the Fourth Circuit enjoined the travel ban.
Right. And so in this moment right now, what does the decision that just came down from the U.S. Supreme Court mean in this moment? What does it mean for now, and what do we have to look forward to into the future with this? Because it's not over yet, correct?
Correct. Basically, coming into the Supreme Court decision, there were nationwide injunctions out of Maryland and out of Hawaii that had been affirmed by the Fourth and the Ninth Circuits. And then the government lawyers appealed to the Supreme Court and basically asked them to hear the case and decide whether the president really had the authority to do this or not, and ask them in the meantime to stay the injunctions, meaning let the travel ban go into effect until the Supreme Court could sort it all out. What the Supreme Court wound up doing was to stay the injunctions in part and leave them in place in part, and then theoretically they're going to resolve the questions once and for all in October, and more about that in a moment. But basically what the Supreme Court order does is to divide potential visitors to the country into two categories: those who have a, quote, bona fide relationship to people in the U.S. or to institutions in the U.S., such as university students, family members of folks who were in the U.S., etc., and everybody else, people who do not have any antecedent connection with the U.S. And basically what the Supreme Court did was say, we will stay the injunctions with respect to people with no antecedent connection to the U.S., meaning the travel ban will be enforced against those people, but the injunctions will remain in place for people who have a, quote, bona fide relationship to the U.S. So it's a kind of split the baby solution.
That was WVU Law Professor John Taylor speaking with 100 Days in Appalachia Managing Editor Dave Mistich. 100 Days in Appalachia is a collaborative project from the West Virginia Public Broadcasting, West Virginia University's Reed College of Media, and The Daily Yonder. For more information, visit 100daysinappalachia.com. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Chuck Anzalevich. It's 7:52. In the weather forecast for West Virginia, mostly sunny today, though isolated thunderstorms are possible this afternoon. Highs will be in the 80s to the low 90s. Variable cloudiness tonight with lows in the 60s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny in the west, a little bit cloudier with a chance of showers to the east. Highs tomorrow will be in the 80s. Support for this weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents are available at erieinsurance.com. The Ohio Valley is ground zero for the nation's opioid crisis, with effects in homes, schools, and the workplace. Many businesses face thorny issues with addicted workers and job applicants re-entering the workforce after drug treatment or incarceration. Aaron Payne reports on how employers can make the workplace support those recovering from addiction.
If you've ever enjoyed a budget-saver twin popsicle on a hot summer day, you can thank the employees of the Ziegenfelder Frozen Treat Factory in Wheeling, West Virginia. Sonny Baxter is responsible for leading the floor workers.
You have to have a comprehension on how the lines work, how to make them run as smooth as possible. You have to supervise the line workers. You're a leader.
On top of his duties as an operator, Baxter uses his training as an addiction counselor to help the Ziegenfelder employees in recovery adjust to workforce reentry.
You have to really have a healthy level of empathy for people from different circumstances and different environments.
Addiction specialists say employment helps in the recovery process. And here in one of the areas hardest hit by addiction, some employers are stepping up their efforts to bring these people back to work in hopes of chipping away at the epidemic. Ziegenfelder President and CEO Lisa Allen says they've embraced their role in the fight by hiring based on a person's character rather than their past.
Businesses really need to step to the plate and participate in changing our environment.
Ziegenfelder's drug-free workplace approach takes steps to avoid drug-related hazards, but it goes further to offer assistance rather than punishment for employees who approach them when struggling with addiction. An agency based just outside of Columbus, Ohio, is working to help companies implement drug-free workplace programs. Working partner CEO Dee Mason believes it's the ethically right thing to do and can make economic sense, too.
If that person stays the course and you've actually thrown them a life ring, those people will come back and be some of the most loyal employees you've got.
Working Partners tailors the components of a drug-free workplace program to meet the needs of a company. Mason says the opioid epidemic has increased the demand for their services in both urban and rural areas, and rural communities present unique challenges in getting employees treatment.
We're raising the awareness of the employers, but now we've got to figure out how to find services that they can rely on. There aren't enough services.
Other organizations across the Ohio Valley are working to fill in the service gap and prepare those in their treatment programs for workforce reentry. Seth Pettigo, a reentry specialist with Life Skills in Bowling Green, Kentucky, says getting a job is a big part of the recovery process.
Some of these people haven't worked in 10 or 12, 20 years, and they're wanting to go back into the field.
The nonprofit mental health and addiction institution incorporates job training as part of its recovery program. But Pettigo says these employees carry the stigma that comes with addiction.
They relapse. Yes, at times they lose their job on the spot. No appeal process, nothing. Depending on the company, though.
Life Skills works with employers to create workplaces that understand relapse is not the same as failure. Pettigo says another chance can make all the difference. Sonny Baxter can attest to that, as Ziegenfelder gave him his second chance after he served time in federal prison for crimes he says were related to the addiction crisis.
I was technically part of the problem.
He was determined to put his past behind him and work to become part of the solution. Baxter began working at the Frozen Treats factory the day after completing his sentence in 2015. He says people who had a past in the addiction crisis are valuable to society, and he hopes he can be an example of that.
People don't realize how successful, how stable, and how goal-oriented you can actually be working in the factory.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Aaron Payne in Wheeling, West Virginia.
The Ohio Valley Resource is a public media partnership covering the region's economic transition and is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, Marshall University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. I'm Chuck Anzalevich.